As everyone knows, is admirably suited to the manufacture of mud, and the road was an Ohio railroad of the good old times. "And pray, what sort of a road may that be?" says some eastern traveler, who has been accustomed to connect no ideas with a railroad, but those of smoothness or speed. Know then, innocent eastern friend, that in benighted regions of the west, where the mud is of unfathomable and sublime depth, roads are made of round, rough logs, arranged transversely side by side, and coated over in their pristine freshness with earth, turf, and whatsoever may come to hand. And then the rejoicing native calleth it a road, and straightway essayeth to ride thereupon. In process of time the rains wash off all the turf and grass aforesaid, move the logs hither and thither, in picturesque positions, up, down, and crosswise, with diverse chasms and ruts of black mud intervening. Over such a road as this our senator went stumbling along, making moral reflections as continuously as under the circumstances could be expected. The carriage proceeding along much as follows: bump, 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 slush. Down in the mud, the senator, woman, and child reversing their positions so suddenly as to come, without any very accurate adjustment, against the window of the downhill side. Carriage sticks fast, while Cujo on the outside is heard making a great muster along the horses. After various ineffectual pullings and twitchings, just as the senator's losing all patience, the carriage suddenly rights itself with a bounce. Two front wheels go down into another abyss, and senator, woman, and child all tumble promiscuously onto the front seat. Senator's hat is jammed over his eyes and nose quite unceremoniously, and he considers himself fairly extinguished. Child cries, and Cujo on the outside delivers animated addresses to the horses, who are kicking and floundering and straining under repeated cracks of the whip. Carriage springs up with another bounce. Down go the hind wheels. Senator, woman, and child fly over onto the back seat, his elbows encountering her bonnet and both her feet being jammed into his hat, which flies off in the concussion. After a few moments the slough is passed, and the horses stop, panting. The senator finds his hat, the woman straightens her bonnet and hushes her child, and they brace themselves for what is yet to come. For a while only the continuous bump, bump, intermingled just by way of variety, with divers side plunges and compound shakes, and they begin to flatter themselves that they are not so badly off, after all. At last, with a square plunge, which puts all onto their feet and then down into their seats with incredible quickness, the carriage stops, and after much outside commotion, Cujo appears at the door. "Please, sir, it's powerful bad spot this year. I don't know how we go to get Clara out. I'm a-thinking we'll have to be a-getting rails." The senator despairingly steps out, picking gingerly from some firm foothold. Down goes one foot in immeasurable depth. He tries to pull it up, loses his balance, and tumbles over into the mud, and is fished out in a very despairing condition by Cujo. But we forbear out of sympathy to our reader's bones. Western travelers who have beguiled the midnight hour in the interesting process of pulling down rail fences to pry their carriages out of mud holes will have a respectful and mournful sympathy with our unfortunate hero. We beg them to drop a silent tear and pass on. It was a full lay in the night when the carriage emerged, dripping and bespattered, out of the creek, and stood at the door of a large farmhouse. It took no inconsiderable perseverance to arouse the inmates, but at last the respectable proprietor appeared and undid the door. He was a great, tall, bristling orson of a fellow, full 6 feet and some inches in his stockings, and arrayed in a red flannel hunting shirt. A very heavy mat of sandy hair in a decidedly tousled condition, and a beard of some day's growth, gave the worthy man an appearance, to say the least, not particularly prepossessing. He stood for a few minutes holding the candle aloft and blinking on our travelers, with a dismal and mystified expression that was truly ludicrous. It cost some effort of our senator to induce him to comprehend the case fully, and while he is doing his best at that, we shall give him a little introduction to our readers. Honest old John Van Trump was once quite a considerable landowner and slave owner in the state of Kentucky, having nothing of the bear about him but the skin, and being gifted by nature with a great, honest, just heart quite equal to his gigantic frame. He had been for some years witnessing with repressed uneasiness the workings of a system equally bad for oppressor and oppressed. At last one day John's great heart had swelled altogether too big to wear his bonds any longer, so he just took his pocketbook out of his desk and went over into Ohio and bought a quarter of a township of good, rich land, made out free papers for all his people, men, women, and children, packed them up in wagons and sent them off to settle down, and then honest John turned his face up the creek and sat quietly down on a snug, retired farm to enjoy his conscience and his reflections. "Are you the man that will shelter a poor woman and child from slave catchers?" said the senator explicitly.
"I rather think I am," said honest John, with some considerable emphasis.
"I thought so," said the senator. "If there's anybody come," said the good man, stretching his tall, muscular form upward, "why, here's I'm ready for him, and I've got 7 sons, each 6 foot high, and they'll be ready for him. Give our respects to him," said John. "Tell him it's no matter how soon they call, make no kind of difference to us," said John, running his fingers through the shock of hair that thatched his head, and bursting out into a great laugh.
Weary, jaded, and spiritless, Eliza dragged herself up to the door, with her child lying in a heavy sleep on her arm. The rough man held the candle to her face, and uttering a kind of compassionate grunt, opened the door of a small bedroom adjoining to the large kitchen where they were standing, and motioned her to go in. He took down a candle and, lighting it, set it upon the table and then addressed himself to Eliza. "Now I say, gal, you needn't be a bit afeard. Let who will come here." "I'm up to all that sort of thing," said he, pointing to two or three goodly rifles over the mantelpiece. "And most people that know me know that wouldn't be healthy to try to get anybody out of my house when I'm in it. So now you just go to sleep now, as quiet as if your mother was a-rockin' you," said he, as he shut the door. "Why, this is an uncommon handsome," he said to the senator. "Ah, well, handsomens has the greatest cause to run sometimes, if they has any kind of feeling such as decent woman should. I know all about that." The senator, in a few words, briefly explained Eliza's history. "Oh, now, I want to know," said the good man pitifully. "Shh, now, shh, that's nature now, poor critters. Hunted down like a deer, hunted down just for having natural feelings and doing what no kind of mother could help a doing. I tell you what, these your things make me come the nighest to swear now almost anything," said Honest John, as he wiped his eyes with the back of a great freckled yellow hand. "I tell you what, stranger, it was years and years before I gin the church, because the ministers round in our parts used to preach that the Bible went in for these ere cuttings up, and I couldn't be up to that and with their Greek and Hebrew, and so I took up again in Bible and all. I never gin the church till I found a minister that was up to him all in Greek and all that, and he said right the contrary, and then I took right hold and gin the church. I did now, fact," said John, who had been all this time uncorking some very frisky bottled cider, which at this juncture he presented. "You'd better just put up here now, till daylight," said he, heartily, "and I'll call up the old woman, and have a bed got ready for you in no time." "Thank you, my good friend," said the senator. "I must be along to take the night stage for Columbus." "Ah, well, then, if you must, I'll go peace with you, and show you a crossroad that will take you there better than the road you came on. That road's mighty bad." John equipped himself, and with a lantern in hand was soon seen guiding the senator's carriage towards a road that ran down in a hollow back of his dwelling. When they parted, the senator put into his hand a $10 bill. "It's for her," he said briefly. "Aye, aye," said John with equal conciseness. They shook hands and parted. Chapter 10. The Property is Carried Off. The February morning looked gray and drizzling through the window of Uncle Tom's cabin. It looked on downcast faces, the images of mournful hearts. The little table stood out before the fire, covered with an ironing cloth. A coarse but clean shirt or two, fresh from the iron, hung on the back of a chair by the fire, and Aunt Chloe had another spread out before her on the table. Carefully she rubbed and ironed every fold and every hem, with the most scrupulous exactness, every now and then raising her hand to her face to wipe off the tears that were coursing down her cheeks. Tom sat by, with his testament open on his knee, and his head leaning upon his hand, but neither spoke. It was yet early, and the children lay all asleep together in their little rude trundle bed. Tom, who had to the full the gentle domestic heart, which, woe for them, had been a peculiar characteristic of his unhappy race, got up and walked silently to look at his children.
"It's the last time," he said.
Aunt Chloe did not answer, only rubbed over and over on the coarse shirt. already as smooth as hands could make it, and finally setting her iron suddenly down with a despairing plunge. She sat down to the table and lifted up her voice and wept.
"Suppose we must be resigned, but, oh, Lord, how can I? If I'd knowed anything, where you's going, or how they'd serve you. Missus says she'll try and deem you in a year or two. But, Lord, nobody never comes up that goes down there. They kills 'em. I've hearin' 'em tell how they works 'em up on them there plantations.
There'll be the same God there, Chloe, that there is here."
"Well," said Aunt Chloe, "suppose there will. But the Lord lets dreadful things happen sometimes. I don't seem to get no comfort that way."
"I'm in the Lord's hands," said Tom. "Nothing can go no further than he lets it. And there's one thing I can thank him for. It's me that's sold and going down, and not you nor the children. Here you're safe. What comes will come, only on me, and the Lord he'll help me. I know he will."
"Ah, brave, manly heart, smothering thine own sorrow to comfort thy beloved ones."
Tom spoke with a thick utterance and with a bitter choking in his throat, but he spoke brave and strong.
"Let's think on our mercies," he said, tremulously, as if he was quite sure he needed to think on them very hard indeed.
"Mercies," said Aunt Chloe. "Don't see no mercy in it. 'Tain't right. 'Tain't right it should be so. Massa never ought to have left it so that you could be took for his debts. You aren't him all he gets for you. He owed you your freedom, and ought to get it to you years ago. Maybe he can't help himself now, but I feel it's wrong. Nothing can't beat that or out of me. Such a faithful critter as you've been, and Aller's always sought his business for your own every way, and reckoned on him more than your own wife and chillen. Them as sells heart's love and heart's blood to get out their scrapes. The Lord be up to him.
Chloe, now, if you love me, you won't talk so. When perhaps just the last time we'll ever have together. And I'll tell you, Chloe, it goes against me to hear one word against Massa. When he put in my arms a baby, it's nature. I should think a heap of him, and he shouldn't be expected to think so much of poor Tom. Massa's used to having all these year things done for him, and naturally they don't think so much on it. They can't be expected to no way. Set him alongside of other Massa's, who's had the treatment and living I've had, and he never would have let this year come on me. If he could have seen it aforehand, I know he wouldn't. Why, anyway, there's wrong about it somewhat," said Aunt Chloe, in whom a stubborn sense of justice was a predominant trait.
"I can't just make out what it is, but there's wrong somewhere. I'm clear of that.
You ought to look up to the Lord above. He's above all. There don't a sparrow fall without him." "Don't seem to comfort me, but I expect it oughter," said Aunt Chloe. "But there's no use talking. I'll just wet up to corn cake and get you one good breakfast, because nobody knows when you'll get another."
In order to appreciate the sufferings of the negroes sold south, it must be remembered that all the instinctive affections of that race are peculiarly strong. Their local attachments are very abiding. They are not naturally daring and enterprising, but home-loving and affectionate. Add to this all the terrors with which ignorance invests the unknown, and add to this again that selling to the south is set before the negro from childhood as the last severity of punishment. The threat that terrifies more than whipping or torture of any kind is the threat of being sent down river. We have ourselves heard this feeling expressed by them, and seen the unaffected horror with which they will sit in their gossiping hours and tell frightful stories of that down river, that undiscovered country from whose bourne no traveller returns. A missionary figure among the fugitives in Canada told us that many of the fugitives confessed themselves to have escaped from comparatively kind masters, and that they were induced to brave the perils of escape in almost every case by the desperate horror with which they regarded being sold south, a doom which was hanging either over themselves or their husbands, their wives or children. This nerves the African naturally patient, timid, and unenterprising, with heroic courage, and leads him to suffer hunger, cold, pain, the perils of the wilderness, and the more dread penalties of recapture. The simple morning meal now smoked on the table, for Mrs. Shelby had excused Aunt Chloe's attendance at the great house that morning. The poor soul had expended all her little energies on this farewell feast, had killed and dressed her choicest chicken, and prepared her corn cake with scrupulous exactness, just to her husband's taste, and brought out certain mysterious jars on the mantelpiece, some preserves that were never produced except on extreme occasions.
"Law, Pete," said Mose, triumphantly, "hain't we got a buster of a breakfast?"
At the same time catching at a fragment of the chicken. Aunt Chloe gave him a sudden box on the ear. "There now, crowing over the last breakfast your poor daddy's going to have to home."
"Oh, Chloe," said Tom gently.
"Well, I can't help it," said Aunt Chloe, hiding her face in her apron. "I'm so tossed about it, it makes me act ugly." The boys stood quite still, looking first at their father and then at their mother, while the baby, climbing up her clothes, began an imperious, commanding cry.
"There," said Aunt Chloe, wiping her eyes and taking up the baby. "Now it's done, I hope. Now to eat something. This here's my nicest chicken. There, boys, you shall have some, poor critters. Your mammy's been cross to you."
The boys needed no second invitation and went in with great zeal for the eatables, and it was well they did so, as otherwise there would have been very little performed to any purpose by the party.
"Now," said Aunt Chloe, bustling about after breakfast, "I must put up your clothes."
"Just like as not, he'll take them all away. I know their ways, mean as dirt they is. Well, now, your flannels for rheumatiz is in this corner, so be careful, 'cause there won't nobody make you no more. Then here's your old shirts, and these here's your new ones. I towed off these here stockings last night and put the ball in 'em to mend with, but, Lord, whoever mend for you?"
And Aunt Chloe again overcome laid her head on the box side and sobbed. "To think on it, no critter to do for you. Sick or well, I don't really think I ought to be good now."
The boys, having eaten everything there was on the breakfast table, began now to take some thought of the case, and seeing their mother crying and their father looking very sad, began to whimper and put their hands to their eyes. Uncle Tom had the baby on his knee, and was letting her enjoy herself to the utmost extent, scratching his face and pulling his hair, and occasionally breaking out into clamorous explosions of delight, evidently arising out of her own internal reflections.
"Ah, crow away, poor critter," said Aunt Chloe.
"You'll have to come to it, too. You'll live to see your husband sold, or maybe be sold yourself, and these year boys, they to be sold, I suppose, too. Just like as not, when day gets good for something, ain't no use in niggers having nothing."
Here one of the boys called out, "There's missus a-comin' in." "She can't do no good. What's she coming for?" said Aunt Chloe.
Mrs. Shelby entered. Aunt Chloe set a chair for her in a manner decidedly gruff and crusty. She did not seem to notice either the action or the manner. She looked pale and anxious.
"Tom," she said, "I come too," and stopping suddenly and regarding the silent group, she sat down in the chair, and covering her face with her handkerchief, began to sob. "Lord, now, missus, don't, said Aunt Chloe, bursting out in her turn. And for a few moments they all wept in company. And in those tears they all shed together, the high and the lowly melted away all the heart burnings and anger of the oppressed. O ye who visit the distressed, do you know that everything your money can buy, given with a cold, averted face, is not worth one honest tear shed in real sympathy?" "My good fellow," said Mrs. Shelby, "I can't give you anything to do you any good. If I give you money, it will only be taken from you. But I tell you solemnly and before God that I will keep trace of you and bring you back as soon as I can command the money. Till then, trust in God." Here the boys called out that Massa Haley was coming, and then an unceremonious kick pushed open the door. Haley stood there in very ill humor, having ridden hard the night before and being not at all pacified by his ill success in recapturing his prey. "Come," he said, "you nigger, you ready?"
"Servant, ma'am," he said, taking off his hat as he saw Mrs. Shelby. Aunt Chloe shut and corded the box, and getting up, looked gruffly on the trader, her tears seeming suddenly turned to sparks of fire. Tom rose up meekly to follow his new master and raised up his heavy box on his shoulder. His wife took the baby in her arms to go with him to the wagon, and the children, still crying, trailed on behind. Mrs. Shelby, walking up to the trader, detained him for a few moments, talking with him in an earnest manner, and while she was thus talking, the whole family party proceeded to a wagon that stood ready harnessed at the door. A crowd of all the old and young hands on the place stood gathered around it, to bid farewell to their old associate. Tom had been looked up to, both as a head servant and a Christian teacher, by all the place, and there was much honest sympathy and grief about him, particularly among the women. "Why, Chloe, you bear it better than we do," said one of the women, who had been weeping freely, noticing the gloomy calmness with which Aunt Chloe stood by the wagon.
"I stun my tears," she said, looking grimly at the trader, who was coming up. "I does not feel to cry for dad our old limb, nohow."
"Get in," said Haley to Tom, as he strode through the crowd of servants, who looked at him with lowering brows. Tom got in, and Haley, drawing out from under the wagon seat a heavy pair of shackles, made them fast around each ankle. A smothered groan of indignation ran through the whole circle, and Mrs. Shelby spoke from the veranda. "Mr. Haley, I assure you the precaution is entirely unnecessary."
"Don't know, ma'am. I've lost $1,500 from this year place, and I can't afford to run no more risks."
"What else could she expect on him?" said Aunt Chloe, indignantly, while the two boys, who now seemed to comprehend at once their father's destiny, clung to her gown, sobbing and groaning vehemently.
"I'm sorry," said Tom, that Master George happened to be away. George had gone to spend 2 or 3 days with a companion on a neighboring estate, and having departed early in the morning before Tom's misfortune had been made public, had left without hearing of it. "Give my love to Master George," he said earnestly. Haley whipped up the horse, and with a steady, mournful look fixed to the last on the old place, Tom was whirled away. Mr. Shelby at this time was not at home. He had sold Tom under the spur of a driving necessity to get out of the power of a man whom he dreaded, and his first feeling, after the consummation of the bargain, had been that of relief. But his wife's expostulations awoke his half-slumbering regrets, and Tom's manly disinterestedness increased the unpleasantness of his feelings. It was in vain that he said to himself that he had a right to do it, that everybody did it, and that some did it without even the excuse of necessity. He could not satisfy his own feelings, and that he might not witness the unpleasant scenes of the consummation. He had gone on a short business tour up the country, hoping that all would be over before he returned. Tom and Haley rattled on along the dusty road, whirling past every old familiar spot, until the bounds of the estate were fairly past, and they found themselves out on the open pike. After they had ridden about a mile, Haley suddenly drew up at the door of a blacksmith's shop, when taking out with him a pair of handcuffs, he stepped into the shop to have a little alteration in them. "These ears are a little too small for his build," said Haley, showing the fetters and pointing out Tom. "Lor now, if thou ain't Shelby's Tom!"
"He has sold him now," said the smith.
"Yes, he has," said Haley.
"Now you don't. Well, really," said the smith. "Who'd have thought it? Why, you needn't go to fettering him up this year way. He's the faithfulest, best critter."
"Yes, yes," said Haley, "but your good fellers are just the critters to want to run off. Them stupid ones as doesn't care where they go, and shiftless drunken ones as don't care for nothing, they'll stick by, and like as not be rather pleased to be toted round, but these year prime fellers, they hates it like sin. No way but to fetter him. Got legs, they'll use em, no mistake."
"Well," said the smith, feeling among his tools, "them plantations down there, stranger,
ain't just the place a Kentucky nigger wants to go to. They dies there tolerable fast, don't they?"
"Why, yes, tolerable fast their dying is.
What with the climate and one thing and another, they dies so as to keep the market up pretty brisk," said Haley. "Well, now, a feller can't help thinking it's a mighty pity to have a nice, quiet, likely feller as good and honest Tom is go down to be fairly ground up on one of them our sugar plantations."
"Well, he's got a far chance. I promise to do well by him. I'll get him in house servant in some good old family, and then, if he stands the fever and climatin', he'll have a berth good as any nigger ought to ask for."
"He leaves his wife and children up here, I suppose?"
"Yes, but he'll get another there. Lord, there's women enough everywhere," said Haley.
Tom was sitting very mournfully on the outside of the shop while this conversation was going on. Suddenly he heard the quick, short click of a horse's hoofs behind him, and before he could fairly awake from his surprise, young Master George sprang into the wagon, threw his arms tumultuously round his neck, and was sobbing and scolding with energy.
"I declare it's real, man. I don't care what they say, any of 'em. It's a nasty, mean shame. If I was a man, they shouldn't do it. They should not."
"So," said George, with a kind of subdued howl.
"Oh, Master George, this does me good," said Tom. "I couldn't bear to go off without seeing you. It does me real good, you can't tell."
Here Tom made some movement of his feet, and George's eye fell on the fetters.
"What a shame," he exclaimed, lifting his hands. "I'll knock that old fella down, I will."
"No, you won't, Master George, and you must not talk so loud. It won't help me any to anger him."
"Well, I won't, then, for your sake, but only to think of it. Isn't it a shame? They never sent for me, nor sent me any word. And if it hadn't been for Tom Lincoln, I shouldn't have heard it. I tell you, I blew em up well, all of em at home."
"That I wasn't right, I'm feared, Master George."
"Can't help it. I say it's a shame. Look here, Uncle Tom," said he, turning his back to the shop and speaking in a mysterious tone. "I've brought you my dollar."
"Oh, I couldn't think of taking on it, Master George. No ways in the world," said Tom, quite moved.
"But you shall take it," said George. "Look here. I told Aunt Chloe I'd do it, and she advised me just to make a hole in it and put a string through it, so you could hang it round your neck and keep it out of sight. Else this mean scamp would take it away. I tell you, Tom, I want to blow him up. It would do me good."
"No, don't, Master George, for it won't do me any good."
"Well, I won't for your sake," said George, busily tying his dollar round Tom's neck. "But there, now button your coat tight over it and keep it, and remember every time you see it that I'll come down after you, bring you back. Aunt Chloe and I have been talking about it, and I told her not to fear. I'll see to it, and I'll tease father's life out if he don't do it."
"Oh, Master George, you mustn't talk so about your father."
"Law, Uncle Tom, I don't mean anything bad."
"And now, Master George," said Tom, "you must be a good boy. Remember how many hearts is sought on you. You always keep close to your mother.
Don't be getting into any of them foolish ways boys has of getting too big to mind their mothers. Tell you what, Master George, the Lord gives good many things twice over, but he don't give you a mother but once. You'll never see such another woman, Master George, if you live to be 100 years old. So now you hold on to her and grow up and be a comfort to her. There's my own good boy. You will now, won't you?
Yes, I will, Uncle Tom, said George seriously. And be careful that you're speaking, Master George. Young boys, when they comes to your age, is willful sometimes. It is natural they should be, but real gentlemen, such as I hope you'll be, never lets fall on words that isn't respectful to their parents.
You ain't offended, Master George?
No, indeed, Uncle Tom. You always did give me good advice.
I's older, you know, said Tom, stroking the boy's fine curly head with his large, strong hands, but speaking in a voice as tender as a woman's, and I sees all that's bound up in you. Oh, Master George, you has everything. Learning, privileges, reading, writing, and you'll grow up to be a great, learned, good man, and all the people on the place, and your mother and father, be so proud of you.
Be a good master, like your father, and be a Christian like your mother. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth, Master George.
I'll be real good, Uncle Tom, I tell you, said George. I'm going to be a first-rater, and don't you be discouraged. I'll have you back to the place yet. As I told Aunt Chloe this morning, I'll build our house all over, and you shall have a room for a parlor with a carpet on it. Oh, you'll have good times yet.
Haley now came to the door with the handcuffs in his hands. Look here now, mister, said George, with an air of great superiority, as he got out. I shall let father and mother know how you treat Uncle Tom.
You're welcome, said the trader. I should think you'd be ashamed to spend all your life buying men and women and chaining them like cattle. I should think you'd feel mean, said George.
So long as your grandfolks wants to buy men and women, I'm as good as they is, said Haley. 'Tain't any meaner selling on em than it is buying.
I'll never do it either, when I'm a man, said George. I'm ashamed this day that I'm a Kentuckian. I always was proud of it before.
And George sat very straight on his horse and looked round with an air as if he expected the state would be impressed with his opinion.
Well, goodbye.
Uncle Tom, keep a stiff upper lip, said George.
Goodbye, Master George, said Tom, looking fondly and admiringly at him.
God Almighty bless you. Our Kentucky hasn't got many like you, he said in the fullness of his heart, as the frank boyish face was lost to his view.
Away he went, and Tom looked till the clatter of his horse's heels died away, the last sound or sight of his home. But over his heart there seemed to be a warm spot, where those young hands had placed that precious dollar. Tom put up his hand and held it close to his heart.
"Now I tell you what, Tom," said Haley, as he came up to the wagon and threw in the handcuffs. "I mean to start far with you, as I generally do with my niggers, and I tell you now, to begin with, you treat me far, and I treat you far. I ain't never hard on my niggers. Calculates to do the best for him I can. Now, you see, you'd better just settle down comfortable and not be trying to do no tricks. Because niggers' tricks of all sorts I'm up to, and it's no use. If niggers is quiet and don't try to get off, they has good times with me, and if they don't, why, it's their fault, not mine."
Tom assured Haley that he had no present intentions of running off. In fact, the exhortation seemed rather a superfluous one to a man with a great pair of iron fetters on his feet. But Mr. Haley had gotten in the habit of commencing his relations with his stock with little exhortations of this nature, calculated, as he deemed, to inspire cheerfulness and confidence, and prevent the necessity of any unpleasant scenes. And here, for the present, we take our leave of Tom, to pursue the fortunes of other characters in our story.
Chapter 11, in which property gets into an improper state of mind. It was late in a drizzly afternoon that a traveller alighted at the door of a small country hotel in the village of N in Kentucky. In the barroom he found assembled quite a miscellaneous company, whom stress of weather had driven to harbour, and the place presented the usual scenery of such reunions. Great, tall, raw-boned Kentuckians, attired in hunting shirts and trailing their loose joints over a vast extent of territory, with the easy lounge peculiar to the race, rifles stacked away in the corner, shot pouches, game bags, hunting dogs, and little negroes all rolled together in the corners, were the characteristic features in the picture. At each end of the fireplace sat a long-legged gentleman, with his chair tipped back, his hat on his head, and the heels of his muddy boots reposing sublimely on the mantelpiece.
a position, we will inform our readers, decidedly favorable to the turn of reflection incident to Western taverns, where travelers exhibit a decided preference for this particular mode of elevating their understandings. Mine host, who stood behind the bar, like most of his countrymen, was great of stature, good-natured, and loose-jointed, with an enormous shock of hair on his head, and a great tall hat on the top of that. In fact, everybody in the room bore on his head this characteristic emblem of man's sovereignty, whether it were felt hat, palm leaf, greasy beaver, or fine new chapeau. There it reposed with true republican independence. In truth, it appeared to be the characteristic mark of every individual. Some wore them tipped rakishly to one side. These were your men of humor, jolly free and easy dogs. Some had them jammed independently down over their noses. These were your hard characters, thorough men, who, when they wore their hats, wanted to wear them, and to wear them just as they had a mind to. There were those who had them set far over back, wide-awake men, who wanted a clear prospect, while careless men who did not know or care how their hats sat had them shaking about in all directions. The various hats, in fact, were quite a Shakespearean study. Divers negroes, in very free and easy pantaloons, and with no redundancy in the shirt line, were scuttling about hither and thither, without bringing to pass any very particular results, except expressing a generic willingness to turn over everything in creation, generally for the benefit of Massa and his guests. Add to this picture a jolly, crackling, rollicking fire, going rejoicedly up a great wide chimney, the outer door and every window being set wide open, and the calico window curtain flopping and snapping in a good stiff breeze of damp, raw air. And you have an idea of the jollities of a Kentucky tavern. Your Kentuckian of the present day is a good illustration of the doctrine of transmitted instincts and peculiarities. His fathers were mighty hunters, men who lived in the woods and slept under the free, open heavens, with the stars to hold their candles, and their descendant to this day always acts as if the house were his camp, wears his hat at all hours, tumbles himself about, and puts his heels on tops of chairs or mantelpieces, just as his father rolled on the green sward and put his upon trees and logs, keeps all the windows and doors open, winter and summer, that he may get air enough for his great lungs, calls everybody stranger, with nonchalant bon ami, and is altogether the frankest, easiest, most jovial creature living. Into such an assembly of the free and easy our traveller entered. He was a short, thick-set man, carefully dressed, with a round, good-natured countenance, and something rather fussy and particular in his appearance. He was very careful of his valise and umbrella, bringing them in with his own hands, and resisting pertinaciously all offers from the various servants to relieve him of them. He looked round the barroom with rather an anxious air, and retreating with his valuables to the warmest corner, disposed them under his chair, sat down, and looked rather apprehensively up at the worthy, whose heels illustrated the end of the mantelpiece, who was spitting from right to left with a courage and energy rather alarming to gentlemen of weak nerves and particular habits. "I say, stranger, how are ye?" said the aforesaid gentleman, firing an honorary salute of tobacco juice in the direction of the new arrival. "Well, I reckon," was the reply of the other, as he dodged with some alarm the threatening honor. "Any news?" said the respondent, taking out a strip of tobacco and large hunting knife from his pocket. "Not that I know of," said the man. "Cha!" said the first speaker, handing the old gentleman a bit of his tobacco with a decidedly brotherly air. "No, thank ye. It don't agree with me," said the little man, edging off. "Don't, eh?" said the other, easily and stowing away the morsel in his own mouth, in order to keep up the supply of tobacco juice for the general benefit of society. The old gentleman uniformly gave a little start whenever his long-sighted brother fired in his direction, and this being observed by his companion, he very good-naturedly turned his artillery to another quarter, and proceeded to storm one of the fire-irons with a degree of military talent fully sufficient to take a city. "What's that?" said the old gentleman, observing some of the company formed in a group around a large handbill. "Nigger advertised," said one of the company briefly. Mr. Wilson, for that was the old gentleman's name, rose up, and after carefully adjusting his valise and umbrella, proceeded deliberately to take out his spectacles and fix them on his nose, and this operation being performed, read as follows. "Ran away from the subscriber, my mulatto boy, George. Said George 6 feet in height, a very light mulatto, brown curly hair. Is very intelligent, speaks handsomely. Can read and write, will probably try to pass for a white man. Is deeply scarred on his back and shoulders, has been branded in his right hand with the letter H. I will give $400 for him alive, and the same sum for satisfactory proof that he has been killed." The old gentleman read this advertisement from end to end in a low voice, as if he were studying it. The long-legged veteran, who had been besieging the fire-iron, as before related, now took down his cumbrous length, and rearing aloft his tall form, walked up to the advertisement, and very deliberately spit a full discharge of tobacco juice on it.
"There's my mind upon that," said he briefly, and sat down again.
"Why now, stranger, what's that for?" said mine host. "I'll do it all the same to the writer of that our paper. If he was here," said the long man, coolly resuming his old employment of cutting tobacco, "any man that owns a boy like that, and can't find any better way of treating on him, deserves to lose him. Such papers as these is a shame to Kentucky. That's my mind right out, if anybody wants to know." "Well, now that's a fact," said mine host, as he made an entry into his book. "I've got a gang of boys, sir," said the long man, resuming his attack on the fire irons, "and I just tells them, boys, says I, run now, dig, put, just when you want to. I never shall come to look after you. That's the way I keep mine. Let 'em know they are free to run any time, and it just breaks up their wantin' to. More 'n y'all, I've got free papers for 'em all recorded, in case I gets killed up any o' these times. And they know it, and I tell you, stranger, there ain't a fellow in our parts gets more out of his niggers than I do. Why, my boys have been to Cincinnati with $500 worth of colts, and brought me back the money, all straight, time and again. It stands to reason they should. Treat 'em like dogs, and you'll have dogs' works and dogs' actions. Treat 'em like men, and you'll have men's works." And the honest drover, in his warmth, endorsed this moral sentiment by firing a perfect feu de joie at the fireplace. "I think you're altogether right, friend," said Mr. Wilson. "And this boy described here is a fine fellow, no mistake about that. He worked for me some half-dozen years in my bagging factory, and he was my best hand, sir. He is an ingenious fellow, too. He invented a machine for the cleaning of hemp, a really valuable affair. It's gone into use in several factories. His master holds the patent of it." "I'll warrant ye," said the drover. "Holds it and makes money out of it, and then turns round and brands the boy in his right hand. If I had a fair chance, I'd mock him. I reckon so, that he'd carry it on one while." "These yer knowin' boys is allers aggravatin' and sarcy," said a coarse-looking fellow from the other side of the room. "That's why they gets cut up and mocked so. If they behaved themselves, they wouldn't. That is to say, the Lord made 'em men, and it's a hard squeeze getting 'em down into beasts," said the drover dryly. "Bright niggers isn't no kind of advantage to their masters," continued the other, well entrenched, in a coarse, unconscious obtuseness, from the contempt of his opponent. "What's the use of talents in them things? If you can't get the use on 'em yourself, why, all the use they make on it to get round you. I've had one or two of these fellers, and I just sold 'em down river. I knew I'd got to lose 'em first or last if I didn't." "Better send orders up to the Lord to make you a set, and leave out their souls entirely," said the drover. Here the conversation was interrupted by the approach of a small one-horse buggy to the inn. It had a genteel appearance, and a well-dressed gentlemanly man sat on the seat with a colored servant driving. The whole party examined the newcomer with the interest with which a set of loafers in a rainy day usually examine every newcomer. He was very tall, with a dark Spanish complexion, fine, expressive black eyes, and close, curling hair, also of a glossy blackness. His well-formed aquiline nose, straight, thin lips, and the admirable contour of his finely formed limbs impressed the whole company instantly with the idea of something uncommon. He walked easily in among the company, and with a nod indicated to his waiter where to place his trunk, bowed to the company, and with his hat in his hand, walked up leisurely to the bar, and gave in his name as Henry Butter, Oaklands, Shelby County. Turning with an indifferent air, he sauntered up to the advertisement, and read it over. "Jim," he said to his man, "seems to me we met a boy something like this up at Beeman's, didn't we?"
"Yes, master," said Jim, "only I ain't sure about the hand."
"Well, I didn't look, of course," said the stranger with a careless yawn. Then, walking up to the landlord, he desired him to furnish him with a private apartment, as he had some writing to do immediately. The landlord was all obsequious, and a relay of about 7 negroes, old and young, male and female, little and big, were soon whizzing about, like a covey of partridges, bustling, hurrying, treading on each other's toes, and tumbling over each other, in their zeal to get master's room ready, while he seated himself easily on a chair in the middle of the room, and entered into conversation with the man who sat next to him. The manufacturer, Mr. Wilson, from the time of the entrance of the stranger, had regarded him with an air of disturbed and uneasy curiosity. He seemed to himself to have met and been acquainted with him somewhere, but he could not recollect. Every few moments, when the man spoke or moved or smiled, he would start and fix his eyes on him, and then suddenly withdraw them, as the bright dark eyes met his with such unconcerned coolness. At last a sudden recollection seemed to flash upon him, for he stared at the dark stranger with such an air of amazement and alarm that he walked up to him. "Mr. Wilson, I think," said he, in a tone of recognition, and extending his hand. "I beg your pardon, I didn't recollect you before. I see you remember me, Mr. Butler of Oaklands, Shelby County."
Yes, sir,
said Mr. Wilson, like one speaking in a dream. Just then a negro boy entered and announced that master's room was ready.
"Jim, see to the trunks," said the gentleman, negligently. Then, addressing himself to Mr. Wilson, he added, "I should like to have a few moments' conversation with you on business in my room, if you please." Mr. Wilson followed him, as one who walks in his sleep. And they proceeded to a large upper chamber, where a new-made fire was crackling, and various servants flying about, putting finishing touches to the arrangements. When all was done, and the servants departed, the young man deliberately locked the door, and putting the key in his pocket, faced about, and folding his arms on his bosom, looked Mr. Wilson full in the face.
"George," said Mr. Wilson.
"Yes, George," said the young man.
"I couldn't have thought it."
"I am pretty well disguised, I fancy," said the young man with a smile. "A little walnut bark has made my yellow skin a genteel brown, and I've dyed my hair black, so you see, I don't answer to the advertisement at all."
"Oh, George, but this is a dangerous game you're playing. I could not have advised you to it."
"I can do it on my own responsibility," said George, with the same proud smile. We remark, en passant, that George was by his father's side of white descent. His mother was one of those unfortunates of her race, marked out by personal beauty to be the slave of the passions of her possessor, and the mother of children who may never know a father. From one of the proudest families in Kentucky, he had inherited a set of fine European features and a high, indomitable spirit. From his mother he had received only a slight mulatto tinge, amply compensated by its accompanying rich dark eye. A slight change in the tint of the skin and the color of his hair had metamorphosized him into the Spanish-looking fellow he then appeared. And as gracefulness of movement and gentlemanly manners had always been perfectly natural to him, he found no difficulty in playing the bold part he had adopted, that of a gentleman traveling with his domestic. Mr. Wilson, a good-natured but extremely fidgety and cautious old gentleman, ambled up and down the room, as John Bunyan hath it, much tumbled up and down in his mind, and divided between his wish to help George and a certain confused notion of maintaining law and order. So, as he shambled about, he delivered himself as follows.
"Well, George, I suppose you're running away, leaving your lawful master." "George, I don't wonder at it. At the same time, I'm sorry, George. Yes, decidedly, I think I must say that, George. It's my duty to tell you so."
"Why are you sorry, sir?" said George calmly.
"Why, to see you, as it were, setting yourself in opposition to the laws of your country." "My country?" said George, with a strong and bitter emphasis. "What country have I but the grave? And I wish to God that I was laid there." "Why, George, no, no, it won't do. This way of talking is wicked, unscriptural. George, you've got a hard master. In fact, he is, well, he conducts himself reprehensibly. I can't pretend to defend him, but you know how the angel commands Hagar to return to her mistress and submit herself under the hand, and the apostle sent back Onesimus to his master. Genesis 16, the angel bade the pregnant Hagar return to her mistress Sarai, even though Sarai had dealt harshly with her. Philippians 1:10, Onesimus went back to his master to become no longer a servant but a brother beloved." "Don't quote Bible at me that way, Mr. Wilson," said George, with a flashing eye. "Don't. For my wife is a Christian, and I mean to be if ever I get to where I can. But to quote Bible to a fellow in my circumstances is enough to make him give it up altogether. I appeal to God Almighty. I'm willing to go with the case to him and ask him if I do wrong to seek my freedom."
"These feelings are quite natural, George," said the good-natured man, blowing his nose. "Yes, they're natural, but it is my duty to not encourage them in you. Yes, my boy, I'm sorry for you now. It's a bad case, very bad, but the apostle says, let everyone abide in the condition in which he is called. We must all submit to the indications of providence."
"George, don't you see?"
George stood with his head drawn back, his arms folded tightly over his broad breast, and a bitter smile curling his lips. "I wonder, Mr. Wilson, if the Indians should come and take you a prisoner away from your wife and children, and want to keep you all your life hoeing corn for them, if you'd think it your duty to abide in the condition in which you were called. I rather think that you'd think the first stray horse you could find an indication of providence, shouldn't you?" The little old gentleman stared with both eyes at this illustration of the case. But though not much of a reasoner, he had the sense in which some logicians on this particular subject do not excel, that of saying nothing where nothing could be said. So as he stood carefully stroking his umbrella, and folding and patting down all the creases in it, he proceeded on with his exhortations in a general way.
"You see, George, you know now I always have stood your friend, and whatever I've said for your good. Now here, it seems to me you're running an awful risk. You can't hope to carry it out. If you're taken, it will be worse with you than ever. They'll only abuse you, and half-kill you, and sell you down the river."
"Mr. Wilson, I know all this," said George. "I do run a risk, but
He threw open his overcoat and showed two pistols and a bowie knife. "There," he said, "I'm ready for him. Down south I never will go. No. If it comes to that, I can earn myself at least 6 feet of free soil, the first and last I shall ever own in Kentucky." "Why, George, this state of mind is awful. It's getting really desperate, George. I'm concerned. Going to break the laws of your country." "My country again, Mr. Wilson? You have a country. But what country have I, or any one like me, born of slave mothers? What laws are there for us? We don't make them. We don't consent to them. We have nothing to do with them. All they do for us is to crush us and keep us down. Haven't I heard your 4th of July speeches? Don't you tell us all once a year that governments derive their just power from the consent of the governed? Can't a fellow think that hears such things? Can't he put this and that together and see what it comes to?" Mr. Wilson's mind was one of those that may not unaptly be represented by a bale of cotton, downy soft, benevolently fuzzy and confused. He really pitied George with all his heart, and had a sort of dim and cloudy perception of the style of feeling that agitated him. But he deemed it his duty to go on talking, good to him, with infinite pertinacity. "George, this is bad, I must tell you. You know, as a friend, you'd better not be meddling with such notions. They are bad, George, very bad, for boys in your condition, very." And Mr. Wilson sat down to a table and began nervously chewing the handle of his umbrella. "See here now, Mr. Wilson," said George, coming up and sitting himself determinedly down in front of him. "Look at me. Now. Don't I sit before you, every way, just as much a man as you are? Look at my face. Look at my hands. Look at my body." And the young man drew himself up proudly. "Why am I not a man, as much as anything? Well, Mr. Wilson, hear what I can tell you. I had a father, one of your Kentucky gentlemen, who didn't think enough of me to keep me from being sold with his dogs and horses, to satisfy the estate when he died. I saw my mother put up at sheriff's sale with her 7 children. They were sold before her eyes, one by one, all to different masters. And I was the youngest. She came and kneeled down before old Massa, begged him to buy her with me, that she might have at least 1 child with her. And he kicked her away with his heavy boot. I saw him do it, and the last that I heard was her moans and screams when I was tied to his horse's neck to be carried off to his place. Well, then, my master traded with one of the men and bought my older sister. She was a pious good girl, a member of the Baptist Church, and as handsome as my poor mother had been. She was well brought up and had good manners. At first I was glad she was bought, for I had one friend near me. I was soon sorry for it. Sir, I have stood at the door and heard her whipped, when it seemed as if every blow cut into my naked heart, and I couldn't do anything to help her. She was whipped, sir, for wanting to live a decent Christian life, such as your laws give no slave girl a right to live. And at last I saw her chained with a trader's gang, to be sent to market in Orleans, sent there for nothing else but that. And that's the last I know of her. Well, I grew up long years and years, no father, no mother, no sister, not a living soul that cared for me more than a dog. Nothing but whipping, scolding, starving. Why, sir, I've been so hungry that I've been glad to take the bones they threw to their dogs. And yet when I was a little fellow and laid awake whole nights and cried, it wasn't the hunger, it wasn't the whipping I cried for. No, sir. It was for my mother and my sisters. It was because I hadn't a friend to love me on earth. I never knew what peace or comfort was. I never had a kind word spoken to me till I came to work in your factory. Mr. Wilson, you treated me well. You encouraged me to do well, and to learn to read and write, and to try to make something of myself. God knows how grateful I am for it. Then, sir, I found my wife. You've seen her. You know how beautiful she is. When I found she loved me, when I married her, I scarcely could believe I was alive. I was so happy. And, sir, she is as good as she is beautiful. But now what? Why, now comes my master, takes me right away from my work, and my friends, and all I like, and grinds me down into the very dirt. And why? Because he says I forgot who I was. He says to teach me that I'm only a nigger. After all, and last of all, he comes between me and my wife and says I shall give her up and live with another woman. And all this your laws give him power to do, in spite of God or man. Mr. Wilson, I look at it. There isn't one of all these things that have broken the hearts of my mother and my sister and my wife and myself but your laws allow. and give every man power to do in Kentucky, and none can say to him, Nay. Do you call these the laws of my country?
Sir, I haven't any country, any more than I have any father. But I'm going to have one. I don't want anything of your country except to be let alone, to go peaceably out of it, and when I get to Canada, where the laws will own me and protect me, that shall be my country, and its laws I will obey. But if any man trifles to stop me, let him take care, for I am desperate. I'll fight for my liberty, to the last breath I breathe. You say your fathers did it? If it was right for them, it is right for me.
This speech, delivered partly while sitting at the table and partly walking up and down the room, delivered with tears and flashing eyes and despairing gestures, was altogether too much for the good-natured old body to whom it was addressed, who had pulled out a great yellow silk pocket-handkerchief and was mopping up his face with great energy.
"Blast 'em all!" he suddenly broke out.
"Haven't I always said so? The infernal old cusses. I hope I ain't swearing now. Well, go ahead, George, go ahead. But be careful, my boy. Don't shoot anybody, George. Unless, well, you'd better not shoot, I reckon, at least. I wouldn't hit anybody, you know. Where is your wife, George?" he added, as he nervously rose and began walking the room.
"Gone, sir, gone, with her child in her arms. The Lord only knows where. Gone after the North Star. And when we ever meet, or whether we meet at all in this world, no creature can tell."
"Is it possible? Astonishing, from such a kind family."
"Kind families get in debt, and the laws of our country allow them to sell the child out of its mother's bosom to pay its master's debts," said George bitterly.
"Well, well," said the honest old man, fumbling in his pocket. "I suppose perhaps I ain't following my judgment, hang it. I won't follow my judgment," he added suddenly. "So here, George," and taking out a roll of bills from his pocketbook, he offered them to George.
"No, my kind, good sir," said George. "You've done a great deal for me, and this might get you into trouble. I have money enough, I hope, to take me as far as I need it."
"No, but you must, George. Money is a great help everywhere. Can't have too much. If you get it, honestly. Take it. Do take it now. Do, my boy."
"On condition, sir, that I may repay it at some future time."
"I will," said George, taking up the money.
"And now, George, how long are you going to travel in this way? Not long or far, I hope. Swell carried on, but too bold. And this black fellow, who is he?"
"A true fellow who went to Canada more than a year ago. He heard after he got there that his master was so angry at him for going off that he had whipped his poor old mother, and he had come all the way back to comfort her and get a chance to get her away."
"Has he got her?"
"Not yet. He has been hanging about the place, and found no chance yet. Meanwhile, he is going with me as far as Ohio to put me among friends that helped him, and then he will come back after her."
"Dangerous, very dangerous," said the old man.
George drew himself up and smiled disdainfully. The old gentleman eyed him from head to foot, with a sort of innocent wonder.
"George, something has brought you out wonderfully. You hold up your head and speak and move like another man," said Mr. Wilson.
"Because I'm a free man," said George proudly.
"Yes, sir, I've said massa for the last time to any man. I'm free!"
"Take care. You are not sure. You may be taken. All men are free and equal in the grave. If it comes to that, Mr. Wilson," said George.
"I'm perfectly dumbfounded with your boldness," said Mr. Wilson, "to come right here to the nearest tavern."
"Mr. Wilson,
it is so bold, and this tavern is so near, that they will never think of it. They will look for me on ahead, and you yourself wouldn't know me. Jim's master don't live in this country. He isn't known in these parts. Besides, he has given up.
Nobody is looking after him, and nobody will take me up from the advertisement, I think."
"But the mark in your hand?"
George drew off his glove and showed a newly healed scar in his hand.
"That is a parting proof of Mr. Harris's regard," he said scornfully. "A fortnight ago he took it into his head to give it to me, because he said he believed I should try to get away one of these days. Looks interesting, doesn't it?" he said, drawing his glove on again.
"I declare my very blood runs cold when I think of it, your condition and your risks," said Mr. Wilson.
"Mine has run cold a good many years, Mr. Wilson. At present, it's about up to the boiling point," said George.
"Well, my good sir," continued George, after a few moments' silence, "I saw you knew me. I thought I'd just have this little talk with you, lest your surprised look should bring me out. I leave early tomorrow morning before daylight. By tomorrow night, I hope to sleep safe in Ohio. I shall travel by daylight, stop at the best hotels, go to the dinner tables with the lords of the land. So goodbye, sir. If you hear that I'm taken, you may know that I'm dead."
George stood up like a rock and put out his hand with the air of a prince.
The friendly little old man shook it heartily, and after a little shower of caution, he took his umbrella and fumbled his way out of the room. George stood thoughtfully looking at the door as the old man closed it. A thought seemed to flash across his mind. He hastily stepped to it and, opening it, said, "Mr. Wilson, one more word." The old gentleman entered again, and George, as before, locked the door, and then stood for a few moments looking on the floor irresolutely, at last raising his head with a sudden effort. "Mr. Wilson, you have shown yourself a Christian in your treatment of me. I want to ask one last deed of Christian kindness of you." "Well, George?" "Well, sir, what you said was true. I am running a dreadful risk. There isn't on earth a living soul to care if I die," he added, drawing his breath hard, and speaking with a great effort. "I shall be kicked out and buried like a dog, and nobody'll think of it a day after. Only my poor wife, poor soul. She'll mourn and grieve, and if you'd only contrive, Mr. Wilson, to send this little pin to her. She gave it to me for a Christmas present, poor child. Give it to her, and tell her I loved her to the last. Will you? Will you?" he added earnestly. "Yes, certainly, poor fellow," said the old gentleman, taking the pin with watery eyes and a melancholy quiver in his voice. "Tell her one thing," said George. "It's my last wish, if she can get to Canada, to go there. No matter how kind her mistress is, no matter how much she loves her home, beg her not to go back, for slavery always ends in misery. Tell her to bring up our boy, a free man, and then he won't suffer as I have. Tell her this, Mr. Wilson, will you?" "Yes, George, I'll tell her. But I trust you won't die. Take heart. You're a brave fellow. Trust in the Lord, George. I wish in my heart you were safe through, though. That's what I do." "Is there a God to trust in?" said George, in such a tone of bitter despair as arrested the old gentleman's words. "Oh, I've seen things all my life that have made me feel that there can't be a God. You Christians don't know how these things look to us. There's a God for you, but is there any for us?" "Oh, now, don't, my boy," said the old man, almost sobbing as he spoke. "Don't feel so. There is, clouds and darkness are around about him, but righteousness and judgment are the habitation of his throne. There's a God, George, believe it, trust in him, and I'm sure he'll help you. Everything will be set right, if not in this life, in another." The real piety and benevolence of the simple old man invested him with a temporary dignity and authority as he spoke. George stopped his distracted walk up and down the room, stood thoughtfully a moment, and then said quietly, "Thank you for saying that, my good friend. I'll think of that."
Chapter 12. Select Incident of Lawful Trade. In Rama there was a voice heard, weeping and lamentation, and great mourning. Rachel weeping for her children, and would not be comforted. Jeremiah 31:15. Mr. Haley and Tom jogged onward in their wagon, each for a time absorbed in his own reflections. Now the reflections of two men sitting side by side are a curious thing. Seated on the same seat, having the same eyes, ears, hands, and organs of all sorts, and having passed before their eyes the same objects, it is wonderful what a variety we shall find in these same reflections. As for example, Mr. Haley, he thought first of Tom's length and breadth and height, and what he would sell for if he was kept fat and in good care till he got him into market. He thought of how he should make out his gang. He thought of the respective market value of certain supposititious men and women and children who were to compose it, and other kindred topics of the business. Then he thought of himself and how humane he was, that whereas other men chained their niggers and hand and foot both, he only put fetters on the feet and left Tom the use of his hands, as long as he behaved well. And he sighed to think how ungrateful human nature was, so that there was even room to doubt whether Tom appreciated his mercies. He had been taken in so by niggers whom he had favored, but still he was astonished to consider how good-natured he yet remained. As to Tom, he was thinking over some words of an unfashionable old book, which kept running through his head, again and again as follows. "We have here no continuing city, but we seek one to come. Therefore God himself is not ashamed to be called our God, for he hath prepared for us a city." These words of an ancient volume, got up principally by ignorant and unlearned men, have through all time kept up somehow a strange sort of power over the minds of poor simple fellows like Tom. They stir up the soul from its depths and rouse us, as with trumpet, call, courage, energy, and enthusiasm, where before was only the blackness of despair. Mr. Haley pulled out of his pocket sundry newspapers and began looking over their advertisements with absorbed interest. He was not a remarkably fluent reader, and was in the habit of reading in a sort of recitative half-aloud, by way of calling in his ears to verify the deductions of his eyes. In this tone he slowly recited the following paragraph. "Executor's sale, Negroes."
agreeably to order of court, will be sold on Tuesday, February 20th, before the courthouse door, in the town of Washington, Kentucky. The following Negroes: Hagar, age 60, John, age 30, Ben, age 21, Saul, age 25, Albert, age